Assalamu alaikum, peace be on you, and hello. Welcome to another episode of Faith in Focus, where we explore matters of faith in the context of modern society. On this show, we aim to take matters from all walks of life and interrogate them under the lens of faith, belief, and the female perspective. I'm your host, Shmuel Iftihar. Today, the world is much more connected than perhaps it has ever been, both on a physical and a virtual level. Advancements in technology have pushed people closer together and transformed communities from homogeneous, uniform groups to vibrant, diverse ecosystems. That is largely reflected in the range of languages that can be found to be spoken in a single town or city. Fusion foods, a mix of dialects, and the adoption of cultural practices and customs, the observance of various religious holidays like Eid, Diwali, Hanukkah, and Christmas are all visible signs of ever-changing demographics. However, even where we cannot physically be present, a few clicks of a button on our phones, computers, or tablets can transport us to places and societies that were once alien to or hidden away from us. It's opened our eyes to new ways of life, new perspectives and novel ideas, and beckoned further progression. Looking at it through the lens of Islam, I believe this is yet another fulfillment of a prophecy by the Holy Prophet, Muhammad, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, the founder of Islam. More than 1400 years ago, he said there would come a time when distances between people would shorten and the world would be open for all to see. Indeed, injunctions from the Holy Quran, the Holy Book of Muslims, foretold this as well. For example, Surah Al-Nahl, verse 9 says, and I quote, "And he has created horses and mules and asses, so you may ride them as a source of beauty. And he will create what you do not yet know." The verse, the translation of which I've just read, points toward the development of newer and modern forms of transportation that go beyond the camels and mules that were once employed as a means for travel across desert islands. And the nature of what those modern modes of transport would be is also laid out in the Holy Quran, that caravans, horses and mules would one day largely be replaced by aeroplanes and cars as popular means for travel was something that for the average mind at the time, an unimaginable conception. To get from one city to another could take days and would have required thorough preparations and expended much energy. His Holiness Mr. Masroor Ahmed, may Allah be his helper, the head of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, relating this prophecy in an address in 2013, further said that the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, taught that when this did happen, the good practices of other cultures should be learnt and adopted while the bad be shunned. However, time and again, we see that Muslims tend to be portrayed as being reluctant to or resistant to integration and a supposed harm to the values of the society they found themselves in. For example, in 2020, a poll compared beliefs held by Muslims in Britain and white non-Muslims and found that in both categories, 1 in 5 of its young respondents reported that they believed there was some, and I quote, unresolvable conflict between Islam and the West, close quote. Likewise, the idea of no-go zones that did not begin in Britain nor with Muslims has nevertheless fueled Islamophobia, with a 2018 Hope Not Hate study suggesting that 32% of British people believed that there were areas in Britain where Sharia law was strictly enforced and from which non-Muslims were barred. While denounced and disproven, that myth still gains traction. But in ending our introduction, we can quote His Holiness, may Allah be his helper, in stating that this misconception that has eroded the minds of some and intensified policies that bar or discourage entry of Muslims to countries in the West does not hold ground. His Holiness said in an address in 2015 on the topic, and I quote, "Islam teaches that a person should not just strive to acquire or desire peace for himself, but should make full efforts to spread peace and harmony to other people with the same longing they hold for themselves." This selfless attitude is the way to establish peace in the world. In today's show, we'll discuss how, from the time of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, to today, integration into society is an important part of Islam. But before moving into that, we have a report read by Qudsi Ahmed.
What makes a good society? That question has been dissected, examined, debated, answered many times, but broadly speaking, what everyone may well agree on is that the components of a peaceful and cohesive society are democracy, tolerance, respect, and a rigid system of law that runs through each echelon. Anyone with knowledge of Islam would not see any contradiction between these values and the principles of Islam. However, that hasn't stopped some countries from becoming institutionally hostile toward Muslims and sought to control their flow from Muslim countries into Western societies, nor has it prevented governments in Europe to try and attempt their own conceptions of Islam. A point in case is France, which in recent years has sought to create a French Islam, or an Islam of the Enlightenment, that counters what French President Emmanuel Macron called Islamic radicalism, even developing a programme to implement it, which garnered criticism from Muslims as well as sociologists who criticised the impracticability and discrimination within it. And indeed, after banning religious symbols, including those worn by Muslims, France recently also banned the wearing of abayas in state schools, stating it violated its principle of laicity, or the separation of religion from the state, only this time it led many to wonder whether France had gone so far into its opposition of all things that represented Islam that it had mistaken a garment worn predominantly by Middle Eastern and North African women for an Islamic symbol. That idea has been repeated elsewhere. There's been a surge in Quran burning demonstrations in Sweden, and the leader of at least three of those this year, Salwan Momiga, said he was protesting against the entire institution of Islam. In its neighbouring country, Denmark, a far-right group, Danish Patriots, which held similar demonstrations, likewise spoke of wanting to prevent an Islamisation of Nordic countries. And in Britain as well, despite religious freedom being a protected characteristic, Islamophobia has been an alarming rise. For instance, a recent survey by ITV News and anti-Muslim monitoring group Tell MAMA found that almost 90% of 117 mosques surveyed had been subjected to abuse, with them receiving threatening letters, being subjected to acts of violence, and in one case having feces smeared across their walls. These cases of abuse reflect the regrettable view that Islam is somehow incompatible with British values, with 48% respondents to a 2019 Comres poll believing so. However, a glimpse into Islamic history shows us the kind of order and social cohesion that Islam introduced and encouraged in society from its beginning. Injunctions from the Holy Quran, the practices of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, and the actions and deeds of his companions and followers paint for us a picture of a social order in motion that was unlike any other. The Holy Quran is replete with injunctions on being kind and compassionate to others, and lays particular emphasis on taking care of the needs of the poor. That responsibility it entrusts to the state of government. Surah Al-Tawbah verse 60, for instance, says, "The alms are only for the poor and the needy, and for those employed in connection therein, and for those whose hearts are to be reconciled, and for the freeing of slaves, and for those in debt, and for the cause of Allah, and for the wayfarer. An ordinance from Allah, and Allah is all-knowing wise." Chapter 9, verse 60. Elsewhere, the Holy Quran also instructs believers to help those who have been forced out of their homelands. Surah Al-Hashr verse 9 says the following, and I quote, "These spoils are for the poor refugees who have been driven out from their homes and their possessions while seeking grace from Allah and His pleasure, and helping Allah and His Messenger. These it is who are true in their faith." Chapter 59 verse 9. In other words, it requires true believers to help those who have been persecuted in order that they can then themselves be able to contribute to society. If we examine this teaching, the idea of social integration is twofold. Not only should Muslims create ease for those in distress, but they are also required to help them become productive members of society. The verse lays the groundwork of a just and fair society, and indicates to us the virtue of moderation that should be taken in supporting others so that they do not, even by chance, become burdens on others. And in the blessed example of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, we see these teachings in practice. Even before his prophethood, he was known to be trustworthy and considerate, known as Al-Amin, or the trustworthy, and Al-Sadiq, or the truthful, even by those who otherwise indulged in the vices he denounced. As a leader of Medina, he established and upheld the Charter of Medina and the Confederacy of Rights, ensuring that both migrants to the city and its indigenous communities' rights were safeguarded. Even after his demise, the social welfare system and treaties between the different groups that had been established continued throughout the leaderships of the rightly guided caliphs or khalifas. Moreover, the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, taught that love for one's country is a part of faith. And the Holy Quran teaches that when electing their leaders, Muslims are to keep their interests of their countries before theirs. For instance, Surah An-Nisa, verse 59 says, "Verily, Allah commands you to make over the trusts to those entitled to them, and that when you judge between men, you judge with justice. And surely excellent is what Allah admonishes you with. Allah is all-hearing, all-seeing." Chapter 4, verse 59. Clearly then, many of the values that make up most prosperous secular societies today are embedded in Islam. So today we'll discuss this in more depth.
Thank you, Qudsiya, for the report. Today I'm joined here in the studio by Saira Bhatti and Hania Ahmed. Saira has recently completed her MSc course titled Dementia Neuroscience at UCL, and Hania is a master's student studying civil engineering. Welcome both. So let's first begin with defining social integration. Hania, what does it mean and why is it important?
Assalamu alaikum, peace be on you. Thank you for having me on the show. Having a solid social connection is super important for a lively and tight-knit society, where neighbours become friends and new faces add to the vibe of our communities. As its core, social integration captures our longing for a less lonely and more inclusive world. It sets up a vibe where everyone can not only survive but really flourish. Life is full of ups and downs, and having a solid support system is essential for feeling comfortable and belonging. This is where the significance of social integration becomes evident. When people from different backgrounds come together, it creates a space to form meaningful connections and support each other, fostering a sense of unity. It's crazy how, even with technology and social media all around us, we can still feel so alone. These days, it's so easy to feel disconnected from everything. Although super convenient, virtual connections often miss out the depth and authenticity you get from in-person interactions. When we connect with each other through social integration, it reminds us that we're not alone and we're all in this together. This can be a powerful way to address the discomfort many of us feel in today's world. It's all about embracing diversity, questioning assumptions, and actively participating in a community built on trust and collaboration. By bringing people together and fostering relationships, social integration creates an environment where people can better understand and empathize with one another. Getting involved in this process helps us get a better understanding for each other, gaining fresh perspectives and form genuine connections that go beyond just casual conversations. It's incredible because it helps people develop empathy, which lets them appreciate different experiences and make real connections that can really make a difference in people's lives. In today's world, where we deal with many issues related to society, it's super important to recognize the significance of integration. It creates a caring and helpful society where people come together to share burdens, celebrate successes, and face life's obstacles as a team. We depend on each other because our different perspectives and shared experiences helps us grow stronger. Social integration is all about getting people from different backgrounds to come together and feel a sense of togetherness and connection. It's all about tearing down walls and promoting connections and creating a welcoming space where everyone feels important and heard. It's super important for making people feel like they belong, helping them understand each other better, and making everyone happier and healthier. When people are socially connected, they become active participants in the tapestry of society. This goes beyond just living side by side. Social integration is not just a fancy idea. It's the ability to make a big difference by dealing with social issues, getting rid of prejudice, and making everyone's lives better. In a world where everyone sees things differently, social integration is like a bridge that brings together different thoughts, cultures, and experiences. It encourages people to step out of their comfort zone, embrace diversity, and appreciate the unique contributions that each person brings to the table. Making connections and fostering understanding brings happiness and fulfillment to people and plays a crucial role in advancing society as a whole. At the end of the day, social integration is a crucial factor in shaping our communities. No matter how different we are, we are all connected, and that connection can lead to growth, resilience, and shared achievements. Embracing social integration creates a future where people connect and understand each other, leading to a vibrant, inclusive society.
Thanks for that well-rounded explanation, Hania. Having grown up in the West, you might be familiar with how some people like to split Muslims into two categories merely based on their observations as opposed to an understanding of Islam, the quote-unquote moderate Muslim versus the quote-unquote radical Muslim. Notwithstanding the fact that there are a minority of people who claim to be Muslims but who will carry out extremist actions that do not reflect Islamic principles, so this conceptualization is very unfair. What it does is it galvanizes support for policies and programs that center around Muslims, and that inevitably puts us all and our practices under scrutiny. We've spoken about this in our earlier report, but I'd be interested in understanding firstly how that difference between a quote-unquote moderate Muslim and a quote-unquote radical Muslim is interpreted, and secondly, why that distinction isn't helpful in your view.
Now, let's dissect this whole labelling of Muslims as moderate or radical. It seems like certain people in the West are throwing these terms around rather carelessly. And to be quite honest, it's rather ridiculous. It's not beneficial for anyone to try and fit the whole Muslim community into these two boxes. Some believe that moderate Muslims are those who follow Islamic principles and practice their faith in peace and abstain from violence. However, the term radical is applied to people who think of engaging in extreme actions. But like every major religion, Islam encompasses a wide range of views and behaviours. The issue arises when we attempt to cram these two small boxes with all these diverse viewpoints. It's simply not feasible. The world of Islam has a wide range of ethnicities, customs, and cultures. Labelling Muslims in a simplified way ignores their great diversity and promotes unfounded prejudice. To be clear, Islam condemns violence, and the actions of a few individuals do not represent the views of the Muslim community as a whole. As stated in the Quran, there should be no compulsion in religion, chapter 2, verse 257. This verse emphasizes how important free will and individual choice are in the terms of faith. It's crucial to remember that Islam and extremism are not the same thing, quite the opposite, in fact. The act of labelling Muslims is counterproductive and brings about greater harm than benefits. It gives rise to prejudice, anxieties, and unfortunately, support for laws that outright discriminate against us. It would be like trying to categorise every sports fan as a hooligan simply because a few of them got a little rowdy. Now that's not rational, is it? Labelling Muslims as moderate or radical doesn't do them justice. It would be like trying to capture the whole beauty of a picture with just two colours. We must give up these labels and educate ourselves to promote understanding of Islam. It's important to have sincere discussions, dispel misconceptions, and acknowledge that Muslims are a varied group of people just like everyone else. Programmes and policies based on these overly simplified classifications are unfair and do not advance understanding. We must dispel misinformation, promote education, and confront these preconceptions. There is more to Islam than meets the eye, and Muslims are not limited to moderate or radical. We should recognise that we are a mosaic of ideas and customs.
And it isn't just individuals and their actions that are scrutinised and labelled good or bad. The spaces we occupy also become suspect. There's this misguided concept of quote-unquote no-go zones that gained prominence in recent years. Although it wasn't initially marked as a way to single out and scrutinise Muslims, this is what it's developed into. Saira, please briefly talk us through its origins and eventual association with Muslims.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you. So Shamila, like you just said, this concept of no-go zones originated in the early 2000s and initially was used to describe areas facing social challenges, often characterised by high crime rates or economic disparities even. However, we can see over time, this term has become subject to great exaggeration and misuse. And if we actually look at the origins of amplification, we can actually trace them to various incidents and discussions around immigration, cultural diversity, and religious integration. And the concept gained prominence in public discourse in the early 2000s, and there was a combined number of factors for this, from media sensationalism, which we can still see today, political discourse, and global events and terrorism, such as the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Now, the aftermath of these events caused increasingly distorted misconceptions of Islam, and there was increased attention in issues related to immigration, multiculturalism, and security. And we see that discussions crept in about certain neighbourhoods and countries being potential hotspots for radicalisation of Muslim youth. And unfortunately, we can still see this today. Now, one of the things is that this term has been wrongly sensationalised, and it has led to the misconception that the values of a secular society are inherently at odds with Islam. And this misrepresentation is not only inaccurate, but also detrimental, isn't it, to fostering understanding and harmony between communities. We see news articles with titles like, "Half of UK adults believe Islam is incompatible with British values," and the only thing they're doing is amplifying this notion of division. You know, now more than ever, it's quite crucial to recognise that Islam encourages active participation in society, promoting values that align with those of a secular society, such as justice, compassion, and community engagement. For example, being kind to one's neighbour does not just mean being kind to the neighbour next door. It could be 40 doors to the left or 40 doors to the right, which is actually a hadith, a saying of the Holy Prophet of Islam, peace and blessings of Allah be on him. Now, a few examples that come to mind are the events our Ahmadi Muslim community holds. For example, we have peace symposiums, charity, community outreach work, our efforts to foster interfaith dialogue, and of course, the constant encouragement by our Khalifa, His Holiness Mirza Masroor Ahmed, may Allah be his helper, current worldwide head of the Ahmadi Muslim community, to increase in our efforts to serve others. So if we look further into what might constitute as the values of a secular society, we see principles like freedom of religion, equality, secular education, democracy, and of course, mutual respect and tolerance, which is so important. Now, if I briefly just touch upon a few of these in greater detail and link them with Islamic teaching, we find a perfect alignment of values. Regarding freedom of religion, as mentioned previously by Hania, Allah states in the Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 257, and I quote, "There should be no compulsion in religion," unquote. Now, the Holy Quran is the final word of Allah. So as a Muslim, who can argue with this? And look at how beautiful this teaching is. So in other words, there should be no coercion in matters regarding to faith. There never was, and there never will be. Following on, if we look at equality, we all know it's often claimed that women have been oppressed in Islam. However, even a cursory research shows the contrary to be true. 1400 years ago, Islam was the first and only religion that gave women the right to an education, gave women property rights, the right of inheritance, and freedom of marriage and divorce. So how can women be oppressed? Similar rights, we see, were not actually available to women in Europe for many centuries after the advent of Islam. Additionally, if we look at the Holy Quran, Allah says in the Holy Quran, chapter 4, verse 125, and I quote, "But whoso does good works, whether male or female, and is a believer, such shall enter heaven." So men and women's equality and spiritual status has also been mentioned in the Quran. So we see no discrimination between gender in the Quran and thus in Islam. So if we look at secular education on the intellectual level, Islam stresses that education is equally important for men and women both. The Holy Prophet of Islam, peace and blessings of Allah be on him, said, "It is the duty of every Muslim man and every Muslim woman to acquire knowledge." Now, if we slightly go off tangent here, in a lot of our events, men and women are seated separately, and the question is often asked why a critique is made. And the reply, I think, is quite simple. Instead of making assumptions that women are oppressed in Islam, why don't you consider asking women themselves? Why do they prefer to be seated separately? So if we circle back to the main point, so this misapplication of the term no-go zones, it contributes to quite a divisive narrative, doesn't it? It creates artificial barriers that need not be created between different faiths and cultures. And although it has been debunked by European police officials and news organisations, the idea of no-go zones continues to circulate and is often used to justify anti-immigration and anti-Muslim policies and the rhetoric that goes along with it. It's so crucial, now more than ever, to recognise the great diversity within Muslim communities and, of course, to avoid generalisations that contribute to negative ideals, such as these whole us versus them scenarios.
Thanks for demonstrating the various ways Islam has been ahead in promoting the very same ideals that secularists favour, Saira. In Europe, we've seen examples of how Muslims do not live apart in our own bubbles, but actively try to participate in society, albeit within the limits that are set by our religion. Anya, can you give us some examples of this?
Yes, of course. So European social integration, especially in relation to the values cherished by our Ahmadi Muslim community, is a topic that holds great significance. In the face of adversity, our community has been dedicated to conveying and spreading Islam's fundamental values, which are peace, tolerance and harmony within European societies. We greatly emphasise organising interfaith events as part of our integration strategy. We are constructing pathways and nurturing relationships by encouraging conversations and promoting empathy between individuals of diverse beliefs. It's an effective method of showcasing the importance of compassion and mutual tolerance, which are deeply rooted in our Islamic teachings. We are dedicated to serving each other, as evident by our involvement in charitable endeavours. We are committed to making positive impacts on the community we live in, from helping the homeless and cleaning up our neighbourhoods to organising blood drives. We strive to contribute to the well-being of society. All these actions are in line with the principles of compassion, justice and serving humanity that are the true Islamic teachings. As Ahmadi Muslims in Europe, we aim to be law-abiding citizens and actively engage in society's activities while maintaining our religious identity. We strongly support equal opportunity and fair employment practice in the professional world. When we challenge stereotypes and prejudice, we embrace the Islamic principles of justice and equality. Our Ahmadi Muslim community is dedicated to fostering inclusive environments and embrace diversity and offer equal opportunities to everyone, which is why we actively participate in workplace integration initiatives. With the grace of Allah, we can blend into European societies while still maintaining our religious identity. It's not about compromising our beliefs, it's about striking a harmonious balance where we actively participate in social events while proudly embracing our identity as Ahmadi Muslims. With the grace of God, we try to foster a deep understanding of Islamic values, which is reflected in this approach. Overall, the examples of European social integration demonstrated by Ahmadi Muslims highlights a positive connection with Islamic values through various activities such as community engagement, interfaith events, charitable initiatives, and workplace advocacy for justice and equality. These examples highlight the importance of coexistence while maintaining our distinct religious identity. I think you all agree that as Ahmadi Muslims, we are proud to contribute positively to the diverse, dynamic European society. We are guided by the teachings of Islam with the aim of benefiting everyone collectively.
But there is this notion that because Muslims are generally very stringent in abiding by the principles of our religion, Islam is our first and superior form of authority. However, Islam does teach us to be loyal to our country. That's encompassed in the concept of hubb al-watan, which translates to loyalty to one's country, is a part of faith. Hania, how do we straddle the line between loyalty towards our country and loyalty to our faith?
So Islam plays a significant role in the lives of Muslims, but it also promotes integration into diverse and non-Islamic societies where everyone may reside. As a comprehensive and universal faith, Islam encourages its believers to actively participate and be loyal citizens in their societies rather than promoting isolation. As demonstrated by the Ahmadi Muslim community, Islam's teachings emphasise the importance of being responsible citizens and positively contributing to the broader community. The Islamic ethos greatly emphasise promoting peace, tolerance and harmony. Being loyal to one's nation is not just a civic duty, it's deeply intertwined with the essence of Islamic faith. The founder of the Ahmadi Muslim community, His Holiness Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, peace be on him, highlighted the significance of actively participating and positively impacting society. This sentiment reflects the Islamic belief that seeking peace and prosperity for one's nation is in line with the teachings of Islam. In Islam, obedience to the laws of the land is essential. According to the Holy Quran, it's emphasized that believers should adhere to authority, as it states, "O ye who believe, obey Allah and obey His Messenger and those who are in authority over you." Chapter 4, verse 60. While this verse highlights the importance of obeying religious authority, it also signifies respect to the legal system in a non-Islamic society. It showcases how Islamic values can align with civic responsibilities, fostering a peaceful coexistence between religious principles and civic duties. Also, the Islamic focus on justice and fairness extends beyond religious boundaries. It is essential for Muslims to actively work towards promoting justice and equality for everyone, regardless of their religious beliefs. Active participation in the different aspects of society, including social, economic, and political, is crucial while abiding by its laws and regulations. Islam encourages Muslims to play an active role in bringing about positive change in society. From the Islamic perspective, it's essential to know that being loyal Muslims doesn't mean you have to isolate yourself or exclude yourself from society. Islam promotes the concept of fostering a peaceful coexistence. It's important for Muslims to actively participate in and support societies, creating an inclusive environment where people of all faiths can flourish. This promotes justice, tolerance, and respect for diversity. Ultimately, the principles of Islam are taught by the Holy Quran and the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, and with the grace of God demonstrated by the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. Encourage Muslims to actively participate in society, follow the law, and make positive contributions to their community. Being loyal to one's nation goes beyond just fulfilling a civic duty. It's deeply rooted in the Islamic faith, which encourages peace, justice, and importance of living together harmoniously. Islam significantly promotes integration by inspiring Muslims to actively contribute to societies, fostering understanding and benefit diverse communities.
Thank you, Hania, for that. I am hopeful that will clarify many misconceptions. We will continue to talk more about Muslim integration shortly after we take a short break. Please stay tuned.
You are listening to Faith in Focus. The promised Messiah, peace be on him, said, "In the state of spiritual expansion, one's pleasure and delight in worship heightens. The heart is opened. One's inclination towards God increases, and warmth and comfort is derived from prayer." Allah.
You're listening to the Voice of Islam Radio, broadcasting on DAB and via the internet 24 hours a day.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Voice of Islam Radio. This is Faith in Focus. I'll now resume our discussion on Muslim integration with Saira and Hania. So Saira, when the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, migrated from Mecca to Medina and became leader, he established covenants and treaties between the various indigenous tribes and the Muslims that had arrived. Namely, he drew the Charter of Medina and the Confederacy of Rights. What purposes did these serve?
Well, I think this is a very important question. So the Charter of Medina has been characterized as a blueprint for peaceful coexistence due to its very success in establishing peace in a multi-faith society some 1400 years ago. Now, at the time of the Holy Prophet of Islam, peace and blessings of Allah be on him, the population of Medina was actually divided into four sections. So first of all, we have the Muslims, and they were divided into two groups. Firstly, the Ansar, who were the pre-existing Muslim convert residents of Medina. Then you have the Muhajirun, who were the Muslims who had migrated from Mecca. The second group were the hypocrites, so those individuals who had become Muslim but were disbelievers at heart. The third group were the idolaters, and these were the individuals who worshipped idols and were divided into two tribes, namely the Aus and the Khazraj. And fourthly, we have the Jews, of which there were three tribes. Firstly, Banu Qunayqa, Banu Nadir, and Banu Qurayza. And just to clarify, Banu means tribe in Arabic. So when the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be on him, migrated from Mecca to Medina to escape endless persecution, the aim was to establish an administration in Medina that would be accepted by all parties and bring an end to the violence. Now, after this migration, the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be on him, emerged as the most obvious candidate for the leadership role, and unanimously, he was accepted as the leader of Medina. So with this new responsibility, the Prophet of Allah, peace and blessings of Allah be on him, was tasked with finding a practical solution in order to establish peace and harmony in Medina's widely diverse and multi-faith society. And basically, to achieve this, he drafted a charter that guaranteed the safety of all citizens, regardless of their religion, and it also brought an end to internal conflicts. The main goal of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be on him, was to create a society founded on high moral standards, and the constitution he introduced reflects this. If there was ever a hint of injustice, the people were expected to oppose it. Now, if we look at one of the more salient points of this charter, we see the recognition of all people as, quote, one community to the exclusion of all men, unquote. This article, which by the way is included at the very beginning of the charter, acts as an outline for the underlying message of the treaty. It marks the establishment of the new Republic of Medina and also the newfound unity between tribes, which never really existed before. Mainly, religious freedom was very important to this charter. It was essential, as tensions were of course bound to resurface without it. Now, if we read up on this, it tells us that after establishing the internal administrative rules in relation to the Muslims, attention was turned to the Jews. Now, the charter guaranteed that the Jews would have the same right to practice their religion as the Muslims did, because, and I quote, the Jews have their religion and the Muslims have theirs, unquote. So this ensured that the Jews and the Muslims could go about their own worship, their own practices, without fear of persecution. In addition, they were reassured that they would be treated equally and that no help would be given to their enemies. Rather, if the Jews or the Muslims were to be attacked, each party was expected to help the other. And it was also decided that if Medina was attacked, all parties were bound to defend it, regardless of the circumstances. And most importantly, all parties were expected to seek mutual advice and consultation from each other. Now, I think it's very important to remember here that the basis for this charter was the Holy Quran and its perfect teachings, which were continuously being revealed to the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be on him. So the success of this treaty is, of course, largely attributed to this, as the articles of this treaty, they were not merely man-made, they were derived from divine teachings. And these were all exceptionally practical methods of instilling a sense of pluralism in Medina. And this was key, and clearly still is key, to establishing a society based on freedom, mutual respect, and trust. However, the most important thing was that the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be on him, as the state leader of Medina, led by example, so he upheld the articles of the charter himself and acted with the utmost sincerity and justice.
Thank you for this. And even after the demise of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, his successors or khalifas continued to safeguard the principles bound in those treaties. Hazrat Umar, may Allah be pleased with him, is credited for inventing the first register for a social welfare system that enabled the state to provide for those who were in need without the need for requests to be made. We see parallels between this and the welfare systems that are set up and maintained by countries in the West. Can you explore in what ways the rightly guided khalifas of Islam continued to take care of the needs of citizens regardless of their religious backgrounds?
Certainly, Shamila. Now, many may not actually be familiar with the history of the caliphs. So the rightly guided caliphs played a crucial role, a very important role, in establishing and maintaining a just, yet compassionate governance system based on the principles of Islam. Each caliph, following the demise of the Holy Prophet of Islam, peace and blessings of Allah be on him, prioritized the welfare of citizens regardless of their religious backgrounds. Again, if we read up on this, we marvel at the social welfare system of Hazrat Umar, may Allah be pleased with him, the second successor of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be on him. Now, Hazrat Umar, may Allah be pleased with him, is renowned for implementing the first consensus carried out by the Islamic government. And the sole purpose of the consensus was to provide food and clothing to all people, again, regardless of any religious background. Now, a stark difference we can see to today's governmental consensus is that instead of using this consensus to take taxes from people or to work out how many youth there were to join the army in times of need, this consensus was solely to ensure food and clothing was provided for all citizens. So this idea of a public register was introduced to keep track of all of those individuals who were eligible for assistance, so that no one would be left behind and no one would be left suffering. And this allowed the government to proactively provide support without waiting for individuals to request help. Now, it's generally believed that today the Soviet state was the first to recognise its responsibilities towards its people in meeting their primary needs, so like food and clothing. But the fact is that Islam had done this more than 1,300 years ago. In addition, Hazrat Umar, may Allah be pleased with him, introduced a range of benefits. So he introduced child benefits from birth, there were old age benefits and disability benefits. And if we take a look at the UK government, we see that this social help was not introduced by any religion prior to Islam. And in the UK government specifically, child benefits were introduced in 1977 and old age pensions in 1909. Public services, such as the building of schools, were also introduced in the time of Hazrat Umar, may Allah be pleased with him. In fact, Hazrat Umar, may Allah be pleased with him, he was so anxious about the welfare of his people that at night in the city of Medina, he used to go around in disguise and he used to see himself if anyone was in need of any help. And of course, if they were, he would help them. Hazrat Usman, may Allah be pleased with him, was the third successor of the Holy Prophet of Islam, peace and blessings of Allah be on him. And he was an excellent administrator. So he focused his attention on the efficient management of the Baitul Mal, which is the Islamic State Treasury. This was instituted as a state treasury during the reign of Hazrat Umar, may Allah be pleased with him. But its roots actually go back to the Holy Prophet of Islam, peace and blessings of Allah be on him. Under Hazrat Usman, may Allah be pleased with him, we see that the infrastructure made great leaps. Roads and bridges were constructed throughout the land, and there was a building of various canals, for example, Abi Musa, Mal, and Saad. And the benefits of these canals actually streamlined various services. So for example, like the supply of fresh water and food transportation. So we can see from these brief examples that the caliphs upheld the principles of religious freedom, allowing non-Muslim citizens to practice their faith without any fear of persecution. And their rights, so the rights of the non-Muslims, were never usurped. And most importantly, they were never pressured into accepting Islam. And this inclusivity is in line with the teachings of Islam, promoting harmony among diverse communities. We can see that the welfare systems established by the rightly guided caliphs actually share some parallels with contemporary welfare systems in the West today. So we can see, obviously, both of them aim to provide for the needs of citizens, foster social justice, and, of course, promote the well-being of the community as a whole. So in a long way, yes, the principles of justice, equality, and compassion that were exemplified by the caliphs of Islam continue to serve as sources of inspiration for governance and social welfare initiatives in various parts of the world today.
But after them, Zaira, the inspirational governance, as you just said, and much more, came to an end. Why so?
Well, I would say there was a combination of factors. So, first of all, after the end of the four rightly guided caliphs, the title of Khalifa was borne by the 14 Umayyad kings of Damascus. And this establishment of the Umayyad Caliphate actually marked a departure from this initial model of leadership which was set by the rightly guided caliphs. And what the Umayyad Caliphate did was that it introduced hereditary rule, so it shifted away from the principles of consultation. So briefly, the four rightly guided caliphs were actually elected by mutual consultation in comparison. So we see a new phase in Islamic history starting, leading to kingship. Other things, so the growth of the Muslim empire, for example, we see that as the empire grew, there was a trend towards centralization of power. And this centralization often resulted in greater bureaucratic structures and a decrease in the direct accessibility of leaders to citizens. So like these individual incidents, like the one I just mentioned of Hazrat Umar, may Allah be pleased with him, going around in disguise at night to see if his people needed help, they greatly diminished. They were not a priority anymore. There were also stark economic changes and inequality that was being introduced through the expansion of the empire. And of course, this in turn led to economic disparities. The equitable distribution of resources, which, as mentioned, was quite a heavy focus during the early caliphates, faced challenges as the empire grew. And I think lastly, I just want to talk about external pressures. So there were many external pressures that impacted the stability of the Muslim empire, including invasions and conflicts with neighboring regions. So these external challenges diverted resources and attention from internal governance and citizens' welfare.
Thank you for that, Saira. And when we speak about community cohesion and interfaith dialogue, in our discussions about Islam, we also hear about the farewell sermon, which was delivered by the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. We've spoken about how, in his lifetime, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, ensured that people of different faiths lived equally amongst each other, that under his leadership and in the subsequent leaderships of the rightly guided Khalifas, no special status was afforded to Muslims, merely for being the followers of the same religion as the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. Unfortunately, as you explored, Saira, this came to an end eventually. However, we didn't lose the wisdom that was exemplified under their respected governances. That wisdom is reflected in the farewell sermon. Hania, can you talk to us about the contribution the farewell sermon made?
The farewell sermon is an important event in the Islamic history. It represents the final sermon of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, before he passed away. This address shares timeless wisdom, highlighting the importance of Islamic principles like equality, justice, and unity among individuals from different backgrounds. In this thought-provoking sermon, the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, emphasizes equality among individuals, regardless of race, religion, or ethnicity. His words are a gentle yet compelling reminder that a person's true worth is determined by their piety and virtuous actions. One of the most powerful moments in the farewell sermon is when the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, stated, "Allah has made you brethren one to another, so be not divided. An Arab has no preference over a non-Arab, nor a non-Arab over an Arab, nor is a white one to be preferred to a dark one, nor a dark one to a white one." This statement here highlights the importance of addressing social hierarchies based on race and challenging discriminatory behaviour that were common in society at that time, and sadly, still are. The farewell sermon also sheds a lot of light on the path of justice and fairness. The Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, emphasised the importance of avoiding oppression. It highlights the sacred duty of protecting the rights of the weak and vulnerable. As an Ahmadi Muslim, thinking about the timeless lesson of the farewell sermon, it fulfills me with a sense of humility and inspiration. I feel as though it's a reminder to take action and work towards a world where everyone is treated with respect and equality. Under the guidance of His Holiness Mirza Masroor Ahmad, may Allah be his helper, the current Khalifa of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, our community actively reflects these values, promoting equality, justice, and peace on a global basis. Another thing that amazes me is that the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, presented this message more than 14 centuries ago. Yet it's quite recently that the world has quite truly woken up to social justice globally. And this is mostly with the power of social media. Islam always has a solution or has addressed what we would call a modern problem. The profound and enduring message of the farewell sermon remains a beacon of wisdom to this day. It seems to me that we are always being reminded of the importance of working together to create a society where everyone can experience equality, justice, and peace. We can still look at these timeless ideas as a point of reference that will lead us to be better and have a more unified future.
Yes, it certainly presented the message that we are equal regardless of our race, religion or creed beautifully, and it's unfortunate that the rest of the world has only recently woken up to the necessity of social justice. It could also be said that there are flaws in the application of social justice. We've often heard His Holiness Mirza Masroor Ahmad, may Allah be his helper, speak about the grave consequences abandoning principles of justice can lead to. Saira, finally, can you briefly summarise to us how the establishment of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community has revived the examples that was set by the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his successors in regard to social integration by way of taking care of the needs of individuals.
Yes, Shamila, so the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is dedicated to reviving the values and practices of the Holy Prophet of Islam, may peace and blessings of Allah be on him, and the rightly guided successors in the context of social integration and fulfilling the needs of others. Through a range of initiatives, the community embodies the Islamic principles of compassion, service, and cooperation with others. So if I name just a few, we have interfaith programs, humanitarian efforts, celebrating alongside the wider community, and lastly, community building. Touching upon these in a bit more detail, I'd like to start by talking about our interfaith programs. So the Ahmadiyya Muslim community actively participates in interfaith dialogue globally. And by engaging in open dialogues and collaborations with members of other faiths, the community fosters understanding, promotes tolerance, and it also builds bridges of unity among diverse religious communities. And a recent example are the Prayers for Peace events being held by our community. Next are our humanitarian efforts. So the community is at the forefront of humanitarian efforts, especially in times of natural disasters. So organisations like Humanity First, which was founded by His Holiness Mirza Tahir Ahmed, the fourth head of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, lead in providing relief and support to those affected by disasters. And this really showcases the Islamic principle of serving humanity in times of need. As a matter of fact, the concept of Humanity First actually originated from a desire to provide aid on the basis of like need alone, so irrespective of someone's race, religion, colour, or even political allegiance. And we can see this beautifully revives the teachings and examples of the Holy Prophet of Islam, may peace and blessings of Allah be on him, and his rightly guided caliphs in taking care of the needs of people, regardless of their religious backgrounds. And I would also just like to briefly elaborate on the Arabic term Huquq al-Ibad, meaning the rights owed to humanity. So in an address by His Holiness Mirza Masroor Ahmed, may Allah be his helper, in 2015 at the International Association of Ahmadi Architects and Engineers, IAAAE, he said, and I quote, "The humanitarian work conducted by the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is rendered entirely selflessly and without any desire for worldly reward. This is not only because it is a basic moral obligation to help others, but also due to the fact that serving humanity is an essential part of our faith as Muslims." End quote. So what better way is there to fulfill the needs of others than by serving humanity? There is none, right? So this revival of examples is further manifested through various activities. So for example, we have regular donations, food banks, fundraising for charitable causes, and engaging in homeless feeding initiatives. And I'm quite blessed because growing up, I have been able to participate alongside my community in carrying out these activities and learn the true meaning of engaging in these events. Lastly, during the celebrations of different religions, so if we take, for example, Christmas, the community ramps up efforts to provide food to individuals who are needy and homeless and distributing presents to the children's wards at hospitals. And I think this really reflects a spirit of generosity and compassion that is inherent in the teachings of Islam. And not only do we promote goodwill and bonding during other faiths' religious celebrations, we also do this during our religious celebrations, like, for example, Eid and Ramadan. So participation in a big iftar is basically a practice where the community invite their friends, their neighbours and their colleagues, and we all come together to break fast during the month of Ramadan. And I feel like this event really reinforces the spirit of sharing, empathy, and of course, community solidarity. What better way is there to integrate into society than by serving humanity?
Thank you, Syra. That is a great note to end our discussion. Thank you both. Now, a moment for thought. The concept of ihsan, which loosely translates to treating others with grace, is important in Islam, and how it can be incorporated in the practices of our day-to-day lives is for each individual to figure out for themselves. But in our discussion on social integration, we have touched upon that being compassionate is a fundamental driver for enabling a cohesive and diverse society. the compassion of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, for his citizens was not limited to his personal conduct. When zakat became mandatory in 20 AH, it was a social welfare system that served the four groups that resided in the city. Through Bayt al-Mal or the treasury, taxes, spoils of war, among other sources of profit, were circulated. He was against hoarding money. One anecdote that shows this is when Hazrat Umar, may Allah be pleased with him, gave one of his properties, which was a date orchard, called Sama, to charity and informed the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, about this. The Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, said, and I quote, give this wealth in charity upon the condition that it will never be sold, never be gifted, and not be given as inheritance. Instead, its fruits should be spent, close quote. He further said, and I quote, whoever is its custodian can take a reasonable amount from it, according to the standard. He can use that for himself, feed his friends, or feed the guests who come to visit him. However, he should not accumulate wealth for himself, close quote. He also discouraged idleness and encouraged others to be self-dependent so that they would be able to become contributing members of society. When a poor man once came to the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, he asked him what he had in his home. The poor man brought over some basic possessions. The Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, sold the possessions for 2 dirhams and told him to buy some food for his family and himself with 1 dirham and use the other dirham to buy an axe so he could go into the forest and chop wood. The man who had been in need established his business and began to earn profit. The Holy Quran states in Surah Al-Ahzab, verse 22, and I quote, verily you have in the Prophet of Allah an excellent model, close quote. And indeed many today could learn from his blessed example. Thank you, Qudsi Ahmed, for the report, and to our studio guests, Saira Bhatti and Hani Ahmed, for the interesting discussion. You have been listening to Faith in Focus on the Voice of Islam Radio, produced by Mrs. Shameen Bhatt. Please tune in again next time for more insightful discussions. Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you.